Kaya Wanju. This is Breakfast with Mark Patrick on 100.9 FM and digital Novel Radio.
It certainly is, and it's about 16 and a half minutes to 8 o'clock now on Noongar Radio, Thursday, March the 24th, 2022. I've got Jerry Georgiadis and Marika Yugel in here in the studio with me. We're going to talk about, a lot of things, really. A lot of things. Welcome to Noongar Radio, you guys.
Thanks for having us back.
Yeah, no worries at all. So, Jerry, what's going on, mate?
There's a lot going on. What I want today to be about is more Marika's story, about how to change your life, about hope, and about how to tap into that hope, and what our systems should be looking like. Family services, child protection, Department of Communities, corrective services, support services, what governments should be about, and what they should be funding, the type of nurture they should be funding, the seasoned expertise they should be getting, the rapidity of actions, affirmative, to change lives, especially for people who were born into harrow and suffering from the beginning of life, unfairnesses from the beginning of life that most household Australians have no clue about,
They're in a world that's been created by myths. They don't understand, lots of them, because they're not looking.
They're invisible.
And they're not looking because they're mostly scrabbling to make a living. And if they don't do that, then they don't make a living and they fall by the wayside.
Yep.
And because they've... because they're not paying attention, the governments can get away with all of these things. Because people aren't paying attention, they're not voting them out. So, tell us, what's going on with this court case?
So, all the court cases you're probably referring to is the class action looming for Banksia Hill. And just last Sunday, in fact, we had one of the lawyers across, a barrister, Benedict Coyne, working with Levitt and Robinson, who are the spearheads, Stuart Levitt, the Palm Island lawyer who won that Palm Island discrimination case, the only one of its type, where a racial discrimination matter of that magnitude was won against the government. That was the Queensland government and the Queensland police, and it meant $30 million, $100,000 each for the Palm Islanders in terms of the police response to the burning of the police station after the horrific, hideous death of Murungi Dumaji, who died within 45 minutes of his shocking detainment. That was a reprehension in itself. He was walking with a basket of crayfish, effectively minding his own business, and an overreaction by a police officer led to his brutal death, killing, in fact.
Yeah.
No one's going to dispute that he was killed, even if no one has been sentenced or convicted for that.
Well, that seems to be a theme, though, doesn't it? Of course, they're killed, they're dead, but whether the officers ever brought to justice is a thing. It really is a thing.
It's an indictment. We talk about the sins of the nation in terms of their origin. We've got to look at the contemporary sins of this nation in terms of the lack of redress and the terms of culpability and the terms of protocol to how to behave equally amongst the human family. And we've got a long, long, long way to go. The human story, the world over and the ages over, is one of having to beg and fight for our rights. No battle in terms of fairness and security of that fairness has ever been won without a long-standing fight. So we had one warrior come over, Benedict Coyne. He's a barrister. Marika met him because she's one of the plaintiffs of the 560-odd plaintiffs, now approaching 600 once we get all the testimonies up for the Banksia Hill class action. Marika spent time in there. She'll speak to it. We've had a lot of lived experience speaking to it. It's pretty powerful because, in the end, a lot of people haven't been speaking because of the difficulties to speak, because of the impermissibility, the lack of permissibility to speak on these issues. Like out-of-home care children also experience, it's not permissible for them to speak by presumptions by law, but many have been speaking out. No one's going to take on the lived experience to take them down and compound them more trauma. Part of their trauma is reduced, and when you validate trauma, you also disable to some level that trauma in terms of its toxicity.
Yeah. Marika.
Yes.
Just tell us, in your own words, what's been going on? Start at the beginning, mate.
So as a as an 8-year-old getting taken from my mum by the welfare and became a ward of the state, and then they let me go when I was 14 and said I was independent enough to look after myself, because I was in and out. I didn't want to be in the cares of other people. I didn't want to be in homes where I was getting hurt.
Yeah.
And it was just, it wasn't good for a kid like me to be like that. So I was in and out of Bankshire Hill to and Rangeview because I wanted to be there. I used to go there just to have a bed, to have warm clothes, to get a feed, stuff like that. But then it was, I thought in there would be better, but it wasn't.
No.
For playing up down the, for playing up in the units, or for a girl just trying to fight me and stuff like that, we got taken down the back and treated worse. Where they chucked us in a cell with no mattress, no pillows, no nothing. Not even food. They didn't give us food.
How old were you then?
I was 14.
Yeah.
And then because I kept going in and out of the system of a state ward and in and out of jail, Rangeview, I call it jail because it is jail.
It is.
And in and out of there, they would like, that's when the government couldn't handle me, or they couldn't keep up with me as a kid trying to survive, you know. So they let me go. And by the time I was 16, I had my own child.
Yep.
And I was trying to reach out, and I used to go and visit my son's dad when he was in prison. I'd like make my mum go in there because I knew what it was like not to have visits.
Yeah.
So I forced my mum to come with me.
Yeah, yeah.
So I can go and see him and support him being his pregnant girlfriend.
Yeah.
And then it was so tough and hard to leave him, knowing that he was being picked on in there and stuff like that. And then it was pretty hard from 16 till then. And, like, so I turned to, when I turned to Jerry and Megan 2 years ago to get more help because no one else would help me.
Yeah.
And they actually helped me change my life around about 10 weeks ago. They worked with me for 2 years, and 10 weeks ago I have a life changing. I now currently work for PCBWA.
Yeah. Who's that?
That is like a demolition and construction team.
Yeah.
And I'm the assistant manager for the crew.
Wow.
And they help me get my house. They help me furnish my house. I do these shows every Thursday, which I love doing to get it out there. Like, never give up on yourself and just keep grinding. But most of all, focus on yourself, but just believe that there's people out there helping you, like Jerry and Megan.
Yeah.
And they will help you. It might take a while, but they'll get to you.
Okay. So the amount of time that you spend in prison between what ages? Like, how old were you when you first...
I was 12.
I say prison, but, you know, yeah, it's called a detention centre. So you started in there at 12.
And I stopped going. I started in at 12 and was in and out until I was 15.
Right, and the foster care system or the...
They let me go at the age of 14. They took me off my parents when I was 8, off my mum, because my dad passed away when I was 5.
What a fabulous system we
have. Yeah, and they took me as a ward of the state, and then just because I was in and out of the prison system and I was playing up in there, they were like, oh, she's independent to look after herself. No, I wasn't.
Yeah.
It's because I wouldn't stay at their foster homes to get hurt.
Yeah. Yeah. And they weren't listening to you.
They wasn't listening to me.
No. Jerry, this thing that they have about not listening to the children that are talking to them when they're saying to them, hey, I'm being abused, I'm being hit, these things are happening to me and they ignore it. What are we going to do about that?
Well, the only out-of-home care child to ever fully tell their story, with the permission, because the thousands of children that are left behind, no out-of-home care child can actually tell their story publicly in the media because of litigation. And media does want to tell their stories, but they're litigation aversive. The only child to ever tell their story was on December 16, 2019. And it was the front page of the West Australian. It was a four-page spread. I went all the way to the Director General of the Department of Communities to get this permission for that child, because it was part of her desire to tell her story. It was part of her validation. She wanted to tell it from 14 when she came into my life. For 4 years I've been supporting her since extreme suicidality. But you'll remember the front page of that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. 76 placements in 12 years.
Yeah.
She was failed from when she was a baby by the Department of
Well, let's
Child.
Talk a bit more about that. I'm going to play the. I've got to play this. These ads now, so we'll talk about it after the ads. Yeah.
Love signs, baby.
This slowdown song is to remind you that you're now entering a school zone and will need to slow down. Safety message from the Australian Road Safety Foundation.
This is a community service announcement from Noongar Radio.
Hi folks, it's Rob. This is 100.9 FM and Digital Noongar Radio Perth.
It certainly is, and it's about 6 minutes to 8 o'clock now. News will be coming up shortly, but I've still got Jerry and Marika here. Marika, tell us a little bit more about the situations that happened to you while you were in care, not necessarily in the detention centres.
So while I was in care, they placed me from house to house because I didn't like their houses, and I was getting placed in rooms, well, on my own with just a little small TV that didn't show anything.
So it was pretty much like a prison inside a house.
Inside a house, and they wouldn't place me. They didn't place me. They wouldn't place me with Aboriginal people. They always placed me with. They didn't place me with Aboriginal people. They always placed me with Wadjalas until. They placed me with my dad's auntie in the end, but by then I was stuffed up, and that's when I started going to prison.
So these places that they were putting you into that were Wadjalal places, how were those people in those places?
They were very nasty.
Yeah.
And they were very nasty.
And they were obviously they had. Put themselves up to be somewhere where you could go
to be safe and have a better life.
Okay.
They were people that were meant to be like working with children, but they wasn't actually. They were working with us in different ways.
I see. Okay. Text line is 0476797601. If you do wish to participate, you could ask a question of Jerry and Marika while they're here, if you wish, because I still have them in the studio. Marika, I want to take you back to the beginning of all this, when this started for you, and that was the situation with your mum seeking help. Tell us about that.
So I remember coming home from school, and I see my mum laying in the backyard. And I asked Mum, what's going on? I see my brother and my sister pack all our stuff up. And I'm like, where's Mum? Did she go to jail? And they said, no, we got evicted. And then I went to go look for Mum. Mum was lying in the backyard on her grass.
Wow.
Looking up at the sky, crying because she didn't know what to do. So then after that, my mum grabbed me and took me. And we went to my pops for one night, and then we had to go from there. And Mum went to the DCP office and asked them if they could help us because we've been evicted from our home, and if they could help my mum put us in a refuge. And instead of doing that, they said, yeah, they'll help us. But instead of doing that, they called the police, and then when the police got there, they had the police waiting in the other doors. And Mum she didn't even know what was going on. Then they about five of them came out of the office and took me off of Mum, and then Mum just started going off ahead and smashing the office up. And just asked them, why did they do that? Why are they taking me away? I was the one that she really lived for.
And they took you away
from my mum
at the DCP office.
At the office when my mum asked for help and support.
Okay. And they didn't provide any help and support to her or you.
No.
And how long before you actually seen your mum again after that?
I didn't get to see Mum again. I didn't get to see Mum at all. That's the reason why I ran off from my dad's auntie and started going to jail, because I kept seeing my mum walk past her house. And I wanted to go to my mum. But Nan would look at me and say, Bub, if you go to your mum, they'll take you off of me.
Wow.
how like do we to sit there and watch my mum walk past me.
Jerry, how do we get the Department for Communities or whatever name they have these days to understand that they need to be doing something rather different?
Look, there's a lot of good work that actually is done by social workers and social care practitioners and child workers in the Department of Communities. There are a lot of weak safety nets. So it's about the principles of proportionality. We've got to recognise what they do, but there's a lot of social workers who are child protection workers who are actually upset with the department, its leadership and its reductionist populism that actually argues an us versus them mentality. They're getting more funding, and they're getting more funding even in the tenure of this government, but it all goes to more caseworkers in effect to remove children in the best interest of the child. They've gone away from the language of family services, which means supporting families and stronger families. They've done away with that because of the signification we have to work with families to actually the best interest of the child, which mean, in a sense, remove the children if it gets too hard. Well, it doesn't matter how hard it gets.
I might be naive or something here, because I would have thought that a department that is directly, it must have a mandate to actually make sure that the interests of the child come first. And if it was me, I'd be saying, well, the interests of the child would be to stay with their parents to begin with.
But they're casting judgment far too fast. They're actually saying that the parent isn't fit to take care of the child.
And how do they make those decisions?
That's the big question. How do they make those decisions so fast without working with the families to...
Well, they haven't even attempted to put Marika's mother
into... Not in Marika's case. From what Marika's saying, her mum got no support whatsoever. They made a judgment on the spot, looked at the poor mother, and then said not fit, and they called time on the relationship and took the child away. And the life they cast this child into, they have to take responsibility, the child that Marika was at that time. An 8-year-old that by 14 had been in Rangeview at 12, had been in Banksia for a year at 14, had been put in the intensive support unit, and that, according to Marika, the Department of Child Protection gave up on her on 14 and put her in a house on her own.
They said I was independent to look after myself.
At 14.
They didn't even put me in a house of my own. They just left me on the streets and said I was independent to look after myself at the age of 14 because I was in and out of incarceration.
Okay.
So it's our leadership that's the problem. While they're in opposition, our governments admit their culpability. In terms of while they're in opposition. When they become government, they take a different stance. We've got to look at what this government in its last 5 years of its tenure has actually employed more than 200 childcare workers, more.
Right.
But the numbers still are where they have been, as high as. We have a country with 23,000 First Nations children removed into care, out of home care. That's the highest it's ever been in the history of this country. It's an abomination. We have 47,000 children in this country removed. We have 1 in 14 of First Nations children in the southwest of Western Australia in the care of the state. 1 in 14. That's an abomination, a hideous reprehension. We've got to say enough.
But they're not addressing the problem from where the problem stems, and the problem stems from poverty and homelessness.
That's a fact of life. All these children, it's about agency. It's about agency, and anyone living below the poverty line, whatever impacts somebody above the poverty line, the stressor that impacts somebody above the poverty line, or in relative affluence, but anyone above the poverty line, what impacts them negatively is 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 times more pronounced below the poverty line. The more crushing that poverty, the lower the income base, the more pronounced that the impacts of that. And then there's the lack of agency for people living below the poverty line to be able to get the support that they need to actually even fight for their very rights, to stay as united as a family, to get the support that they need to get housing security, to actually wade through the legal quagmire that's actually child protection and the children's court and the like or whatever, right? But in the end, they've employed 200 caseworkers in the last 5 years, and they've still not reduced significantly the rates. They're still not putting in the types of family supports that need to be done.
Well, because they're not addressing the original problems to begin with. There's no extra housing being built. There's no more people being put into social housing. The poverty line is getting worse.
It comes through the lack of knowledge. They've got surface-level understandings. Yep, there's poverty. Yep, there's pronounced negative behaviours within that poverty. They don't understand the layers of the psychosociality that need to be addressed. They don't understand that they have to nurture these young individuals individuals, whether it's on a mentoring basis with families, whether it's supporting the families themselves who have lived disadvantages similarly to what their children are actually living themselves. We haven't interrupted the cycle of intergenerational trauma.
Well, it's got to be scary for those parents thinking to themselves, look, my kids are going to end up worse off than me.
Well, that is the legacy. And without the types of support, it's a slap in the face. What we have done in this country in the last decade is deny the deficit discourse. We have a censorship of omission. We actually want to go all strength-based discourse. Strength-based discourse is important to see the ways forward, but we've got to have principles of proportionality. The grim realities have to be told by principles of proportionality equal to some. Otherwise, we don't let household Australians and we don't let them understand the suffering and disadvantage that people are being born into.
It all seems to be hidden by the mainstream media.
Invisible. Censorship by omission. But the mainstream media is also encumbered by legal quagmires themselves where they're going to be litigated against if they actually speak to out-of-home care children.
Because we have governments that make laws that say you can't talk about
and
this.
And it's not extra-legal. That's actually, in effect, extrajudicial. They've taken on powers to actually entrench censorship by omission as if it's in the best interest of the child or the best interest of the individual.
So it seems to me that it's only ever in the best interest of the perpetrators, and the perpetrators are, number one, the departments that don't do what they're meant to be doing, and number two, the governments that don't provide social housing and decent wages and making sure that people are getting paid a proper hourly rate for the work that they do. And most of the time, we've got people now that are actually working full time and they're living on the poverty line because the wages suck so bad. Like, this is a problem throughout the country.
The socioeconomic stresses and the cost of living as worse as they've been in my living experience, and I'm 60 years old now and I've got 5 decades of memory, and we are at worse socioeconomically
so
than ever before.
And worse than
the deregulation of the 80s and the wages accord. There's been a stagnation ever since, and it's just got worse and worse and worse, and the poverty's entrenched, and there's a permanence of that poverty, and the proximal value to that poverty's entrenched. Yeah. And people are struggling, and as if they're being blindsided to just worry about how they're going to get over the hump, how they're going to deal with their pile of bills,
like I
how
said
they're
before,
going to survive.
They're all scrabbling. And
we've
they
got
can't...
people in survival yeah. modality, as you've said, survival modality. And then we've got people like the courageous Marika, who's actually should have been another stat, but has fought and climbed mountains to get to where she is. And now she's not just, you know, a worker, she's a project admin. She's actually helping people in terms of their lives. And she's working on a pretty powerful project at the moment. And she's got a powerful story where she's climbed the worst of what there is. So there's also hope.
There is hope.
As long as you keep fighting, eh?
Yeah, you just got to keep fighting. Yeah. Fighting, and when you get that opportunity, don't let go, just keep hold of it because it'll get you there.
Excellent, you guys.
But there's one thing that Marika said, it's Megan and I aren't miracle workers.
No.
We're just ordinary people with extraordinary hearts, but in the end we've only got ordinary hearts in reality.
Yeah.
And we're equal to each other.
Well,
the type of work that we've put in is the work that should have been put in. It isn't extraordinary work. It's nurture.
Yeah.
It's just being there.
Mm-hmm.
It's believing in someone till they believe in themselves. It's getting and not giving up on them. That's the type of work that should have been put in when Marika was actually aged 8, when mum needed help, when Marika's family needed help, when her siblings needed help. And that opportunity was granted again and again at 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 years of age, 12 years of age of range.
And they just give up on 14.
Yeah.
14 years of age at Banksia, and 14 years of age the department gave up on her, from what Marika's saying.
And they were meant to be my carers till I was 18.
And had that seasoned expertise been nurtured into her life and invested in, and that's what we should be supporting.
Yeah.
That's what we should be investing in, and that's what our government should be rolling out.
Should be.
And what a legacy that would be if our governments were going down a social good, a social reform. All they talk about is jobs, the economy, and basic service level issues and the issues of our day, as opposed to the pressing issues of our time.
Well, they don't even provide services. All these governments, and it doesn't matter what ilk of government they are in Australia, all they seem to be able to want to do is prefer to have government services provided by corporations and business whose only motive is profit and getting more money for their shareholders, so that the services that they end up providing are absolutely minimal while they scrape off the profit.
Brother, Megan and I recently met with the Deputy Premier of the state at their parliamentary offices. So the Deputy Premier, who we've known for a while nevertheless anyway, all of us have known each other and yourself and all of them, all these people that are now government, that are now ministers. But the Deputy Premier of the state, the second most powerful man in this state, individual in this state, met with us. We talked at length about all these issues of deficits and Banksia Hill and all the social reforms that should be leading the way. What I said to him is, we don't have to wait till we get to the courts to compel change in terms of Banksia Hill. We can make it a better place, a fairer place, a more loving place, a more nurturing place. And what a legacy that would be for your government. And I said, Roger, and, you know, I think he listened, but it's the acting that needs to translate. It's the stepping up that needs to translate. It's the leadership that Hilton Quayle, the judge, president of the Children's Court, demonstrated in that rarity that's not even once in a generation, that type of leadership, where he spoke out against the government, where he spoke out against the fails, where he spoke out against Banksia Hill as not being fit for purpose. So I said to Roger, your government has built less public housing than the previous government. You've been in government for 5 years. Never in my wildest nightmare did I expect that a Labor government would build less public housing, less social housing than its Liberal predecessors. Barnett and Holt, Colin Holt, the housing minister, took it from 39,000 to 44,000 houses, public houses, and we thought that that was nowhere anywhere near the unmet need or whatever, which was 16,000 houses needing to
we
be built at the time.
We have a waiting list that's
we've gone 10 years long. We've gone from 44,000 houses to 42,500 under this government in the last 5 years. That is going backwards. But when I said, the $5 billion that you guys have got, you could have met all unmet need. What a legacy to meet all unmet need. What a legacy.
That'd be good. Words from our sponsors, folks. I'm going to keep them here so we can keep talking.
Australia's making positive energy, which means less emissions and more jobs right across the nation. For truckies like Rafa and tradies like Smithy and, of course, techies like Susie. Not for you, Roger, though. It's because you're a cockatoo, Roger. We're creating thousands of new jobs because we know it's what we do today that will define how we live tomorrow. Australia's making positive energy. Find out more at positiveenergy.gov.au. That's enough, Roger. Authorised by the Australian Government, Canberra.
Station sponsor.
Love signs, baby.
This slowdown song is to remind you that you're now entering a school zone and will need to slow down. Safety message from the Australian Road Safety Foundation.
This is a community service announcement from Noongar Radio.
I'm Ross. You're listening to 100.9 FM and digital Noongar Radio Perth.
The Breakfast Show with Mark Patrick on 100.9 FM and digital
Noongar
Radio.
Yes, and I've still got them here. It's 21 and a half minutes past 8 o'clock. I won't have them for much longer, though. So, Jerry, Marika, tell us the sort of things that people can do to actually assist, like, especially with this federal election coming up. Let's talk about that.
Well, quickly, last Sunday we had a gathering, a barbecue at Tomato Lake in Rivervale, and we had the Banksia Hill lawyer come out, Benedict Coyne, to meet some of the Banksia Hill detainees. Quite a few turned out there for him. Marika was there herself too.
Yeah.
Others came in support. The more coming out to actually join in and be part of the campaigns would be great. By the way, the lawyer who is actually acting in this matter with Banksia Hill and has added himself to the team, he's been added to the team of our four powerhouse lawyers from four states now, other than Western Australia, in the Banksia Hill class action. He was also here to actually speak in the courts, to present in the courts, because a writ's been served on the West Australian government and its instruments of the states in terms of culpability to the loss of Miss Dew, her life lost. And it's to do with the unpaid fines that actually saw her locked up.
Yeah.
There's also a class action about the unpaid fines that we've galvanised and launched to redress to the tens, to the thousands, up to 10,000 who have been criminalised and incarcerated or locked up in police watch houses or in jail cells because they couldn't afford to pay their fines. Also part of the campaign that we're doing now is actually trying to get income assessed-sized fines, fines that are equal
punitive. But we talked about that.
Yeah, we talked about that.
Yeah.
And to make them fairer for all. But more people just need to come contact us, get involved. The campaigns are many. We're not limited to just these campaigns.
Yep.
These are the pressing issues of our times. They can lead to loss of life, as we have described, and ruination of life, as Marika has described, and climb mountains to gather. But if one thing that I can do, well, I'll just say it straight. Just vote for us in the election. Register to vote. It's important to register to vote because your vote is powerful. And in terms, we're asking to be the first independents in 51 years from Western Australia to the Australian Senate. If they vote one for Cracker and George Artis above the line, that'd be great.
Yep.
And that'd be wonderful. And that'd be, and we will take, as we've brought here today, the lived experience, we'll take that voice into the Senate and let what the education that your listeners are getting, and many of them who actually already know this stuff, but others don't, the majority don't, the Marika Ugal stories, let them come through the Senate, let them reverberate, let them educate vacate our Australian Senate so it makes decisions, because it was our Australian Senate in 2019 that voted against raising the age for yeah. children in detention. They yeah. voted against it. Yeah. They voted against that.
It's ridiculous.
And it's ridiculous.
It is.
Merica.
Thank you.
Thank you, you guys. I really appreciate you coming in, and thanks for giving your time to Noongar Radio.
Thank you very much.
Thank no you worries. For Noongar Radio and taking us out.
Hey, no worries. No worries. Here's some music, guys. Here's The Herd, Freedom Samba.